Welcome, and thank you so much for joining the Equal Voice Action virtual discussion, Civil and Human Rights Under the Trump Administration. I'm Henry A.J. Ramos. I'm the Executive Director of Equal Voice Action, and we're most excited to have all of you here with us today. This is the third in a multi-part discussion series that has involved discussions with leading advocacy experts and social justice leaders about how Equal Voice Action members, allied organizations, and fellow activists can best defend and advance our work across a range of issues in today's very challenging political climate. We're very honored indeed to have with us today yet another exceptional panel of speakers who are working on the front lines to protect and advance equal rights and opportunities across this great nation. Today's conversation features Anthony Romero, the New York-based executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, more popularly known, of course, as the ACLU. And of course, the ACLU is the nation's leading civil rights advocacy and social justice membership organization. For commentary and allied observations, we're also joined today from Los Angeles by Stuart Kuo, a founding principal of Asian Americans Advancing Justice, and from Chicago by Rami Nasha Shibi, executive director of the Inner City Muslim Action Network. Of course, all of these individuals serve as informing leaders in response to the many new and very alarming challenges being posed to the hard-fought gains achieved over recent decades by the progressive social justice field. We're very fortunate to be joined by leaders and friends of this caliber and stature, and I appreciate all of our call participants joining me and welcoming these impressive leaders to today's conversation. Now, before we get started, let's go over just a few housekeeping details. First, for all of our audience members out there today, your microphones will be muted for the length of the discussion, but obviously, we want to hear your thoughts and your questions. So please use the question function on the control panel in front of you on your screen to chime in and submit any questions that you may have for the panel as we move along. We'll try to cover as many of those questions as we can in a dedicated Q&A session toward the end of the discussion. But if we don't get to your question today, don't be discouraged. Just be sure to stay tuned to equalvoiceaction.com and join us for more discussions and learning opportunities in the weeks and months ahead. We'll be recording and sharing out this discussion on the Equal Voice Action website, where you can find additional news, tools, and resources for advancing our work. And while you are there, if you have not done so already, we welcome, indeed we urge you, to become an Equal Voice Action member. Do that today and do it for free by using the code EVAFREE, E-V-A-F-R-E-E. Now, for today's important discussion, I want to thank each of our distinguished speakers for being here to share their important views and their expertise with our audience members. We're here to discuss the very real threats to human and civil rights posed by the actions and policy agenda of the Trump administration and the Republican-controlled U.S. Congress, which have moved very quickly, as we've seen during recent weeks, to roll back or otherwise undermine progressive reforms and policies. As we dig into these challenges, we want to focus on highlighting concrete strategies and action steps wherever possible, both defensive and proactive, that we and our allies alike can take to stand up for equal rights and advance the cause that we care most about, justice. We want to make America a more just, inclusive, and prosperous nation. We have a lot to talk about, so let's get started. I'm going to start with my dear longtime friend, Anthony Romero, who is probably the most busy man in America today. Anthony, thank you so much for making time to join us.
Sure, Henry. Great to be with you, and thanks for inviting me to the Equal Voice Action Network. Great to be here with you.
Great to have you as part of the family. I've got a number of things I want to dig into with you, Anthony, before we bring Stuart and Rami into the mix. But one of the things I want to remind our audience about is something that just was brought forward in my thoughts in preparing for this session, which is that when Anthony Romero was appointed to head the ACLU, he's still a young man, but he was a very young man at that time. And if I'm not mistaken, Anthony, your first week on the job, I think your second day on the job was 9/11. And I think if I'm not mistaken, you had a major board meeting and a donor engagement at the very time that those planes hit the Trade Center. And the reason I bring that up is because in the last weeks, I've been thinking, my goodness, is there ever a time in history that we can think of where we've been faced with the scope and level of challenges that we're getting out of this Trump administration? And I would argue that perhaps the answer is no. But nevertheless, going back in your history, you faced some pretty daunting challenges. It's not like this is a new chapter for you. So how does it compare? Give me a sense of the level of anxiety, concern, or stress that you're feeling now versus then.
I guess I've gotten used to it. So I'm not the young man I was. I was 35 when I started here, and now I'm 51. so you can do the math. So look, there are a couple of things that are similar, and there are a couple of things that are different. I think what's similar, you know, is that obviously we're confronting a civil liberties crisis that will change the way we live our lives. And in a lot of the same kind of moments after 9/11, when our political leaders used, at that time they used a national tragedy. This time around they're using a national election. But they used a national tragedy after 9/11 to push through an ideological agenda. It was an excuse. It was a way for the Bush administration to pull off the shelves many of the policy proposals and their wish lists that they had never been able to convince Congress to enact. And then in the aftermath of the 9/11 attacks, where there were so few voices of reason or of asking the tough questions of the president, that they just ran through a political and policy agenda that had enormous impact on our rights and liberties. You remember, Henry, that after 9/11, they enacted the Patriot Act within 30 days of the 9/11 attacks. And even at that point, liberals, good liberals, like people like Senator Wellstone, who I had a kind of a very heated discussion with a couple weeks before he died in that tragic plane crash, they were unwilling to ask the tough questions of George Bush. They thought this was a time to stand behind the president, that we need to rally as a nation, and they just gave it the imprimatur, they just stamped whatever he asked for, they basically gave him. And then over time, the opposition to many of those policies on the Patriot Act, on Guantanamo, on torture, on surveillance, it would build in crescendo. This time around, the Trump administration has used another big disruptive event, this time the national election. It wasn't the tragedy of the 9/11 terrorist attacks, but this election that caught many by surprise. And they have begun to double down on their ideological agenda. What's different this time around is that the hard questions are being asked from the get-go. People are turning out in the streets. They're the protests, spontaneously, you know, organized by on Facebook or on Twitter. People clearly disagreeing with the president's statements on Planned Parenthood and reproductive rights, on women, on immigrants, on the Muslim ban, on the Affordable Care Act, which we now see playing out in town hall. And so actually, if you compare this civil liberties crisis, I think this one is even bigger than the events of 9/11. After 9/11, we changed our nation's laws on national security, on immigration. We deported thousands of immigrants, most of them South Asian or Arab or Muslim. We started populating Guantanamo as a rights-free zone. But the impact on many or on millions of Americans was somewhat limited. We would find that out later on in time with the whole NSA surveillance program that was kept in secret. With the Trump policies, however, the impact on the lives of millions of Americans is apparent from the start. We see the impact on Muslims and our Muslim brothers and sisters across the country who were the initial targets of this Muslim ban. And after a week after the president's inauguration, he signed that first executive order. We see the impact on the lives of millions of undocumented immigrants who Mr. Trump promises to deport and has begun to scale up the detention deportation machinery of the Department of Homeland Security. We will see the impact on the lives of millions of women and men who won't have access to the essential services of Planned Parenthood if they successfully defund Planned Parenthood. So this time around, I think that the stakes are even higher. The place where I draw comfort, and I wrap up with this, is the fact that the people are paying attention. The press is asking the hard questions. People are turning out on the street. That our sister organizations like Stewart's and also Rami's organization are beginning to kind of also galvanize and push their own constituents into direct action, into protest, into lobbying our state legislatures. So, in a lot of ways, even though the stakes are much higher, and even though this administration with the complete control of both houses of Congress has so much more power, I actually am much more hopeful this time around.
Thank you, Anthony. And that's really encouraging because I hear you loud and clear on the argument that the challenge is higher, but it's really, really important to hear you say that you are seeing early signs that the response is more robust and more hopeful and promising in terms of what good may come out of this, at least from our point of view. Yeah.
And the impact is immediately evident.
Excellent. Well, let me go back to something I alluded to at the start when we got the conversation going, and that is just the sheer weight and scale of the challenges that we're facing. I suspect there's some intentionality about this. I don't think that's by mistake that we're having to fight on all these different fronts, but
yeah.
From human and civil rights, issues ranging from immigration and refugee policy to reproductive rights, which you've alluded to, and from federal education practice to environmental labor protections, I mean, you name it. They're really coming hard. Pretty heinous proposals. How should grassroots leaders like those on the phone who are concerned about these issues be communicating, coalescing, prioritizing, and otherwise responding? And what is the ACLU doing, by the way, in terms of its own overall strategic response to this major challenge?
So look, the work of grassroots activists is critically important right now. You know, organizations like mine that have a long history, or organizations like Stewart's, where we bring lawsuits in federal court, we will continue to do the hard work, and we will continue to bring those lawsuits. We already have brought over a dozen cases challenging the Muslim ban in various jurisdictions across this country. There are more than 30 cases now that are brought by other groups, by some of the state's attorney generals, and that's terrific, because part of what you want is you want to use litigation to challenge the worst of the abuses. We think that so much of what President Trump has proposed is so patently unconstitutional that we have a good shot at winning these cases. And even the kind of the naysayers who thought, oh, Anthony, if you try to challenge the Muslim ban, you'll never succeed, we knew better. We were more confident. It's so clearly that these two executive orders are animated by unlawful, unconstitutional, un-American bias, right? And bias against groups of certain national origin and certain religious groups. That we knew that many of these issues would be properly positioned for a court that would ultimately strike it down. And so far, so good. It's fantastic to the fact that here we are on March, 18th, 19th, where we are dealing with, you know, 2 months of the Trump administration, and they haven't been able to check off the first thing on their to-do list, right? The Muslim ban was among the first of the executive orders he signed. And he still has gotten nowhere with it, because the federal courts have stopped him dead in his tracks. And it's been clearly as a result of the clear racial and religious bias of the president's own statements around what's involved in this ban. You know, he promised us a Muslim ban as he ran for a candidate. When he became president, he reiterated the need to ban the Muslims. And then he drafted an executive order the first time around that was clearly a ban meant to target Muslims. It was a specific part of the executive order that exempted minority religions from the countries that were predominantly Muslim as a way to give preference to Christians. You're not allowed to do that in our America, right? The Establishment Clause says that you cannot discriminate against or favor any one religion. And clearly that minority religion exception in the first executive order was meant to do exactly that. So we were off to the races. And I think it's important that we keep putting the pressure on the Trump administration. And that's why I'm heartened that you have many nonprofit groups bringing these lawsuits. The more, the better. That you have these state attorneys general who are bringing these lawsuits. It's critically important, because if we can galvanize the public attention, which is the second thing that litigation does, it kind of frames the issue for the broader public. You know, it's harder to talk about executive orders or plenary power of the president or the Congress over immigration matters. But if you can kind of encapsulate kind of what this issue is all about in for the public so they can digest it, and litigation is a key narrative in that way. There are the good guys, that's us on the call. There are the bad guys, that's the Trump administration. There's a clash. There's a denouement where the courts adjudicate and decide, and then we live to appeal or fight another day. It's a critical way to galvanize the public's attention, just like what we saw with the same-sex marriage fight, the way that the same-sex marriage battle in federal courts galvanized the LGBTI community. But third and most importantly, litigation can bog them down. You know, we can gum up the machinery of the Trump administration. We make it harder for them to move onto the next thing onto their to-do list. And as I said before, it's already clear that it's happening that way, right? They haven't been able to move very far down this path because the Muslim ban was such kind of a major disaster for them, that here we are 2 months later and they're still trying to get the Muslim ban enacted. And the more we can rob them of the momentum, and the more we can gum up their machinery, the more we can kind of stall in the courts where they don't get a chance to implement on their actual policies, all to the good. Now, an essential part of the litigation work is the organizing and the advocacy, because lawyers can't do it alone. And really, it's the pressure coming from the public, the people who spontaneously turned up at these protests at airports and at courthouses, who said that the ban on Muslims was un-American, who talked about this being a nation of immigrants, the fantastic marches that were organized the day after inauguration on women's rights have really laid, they threw down the gauntlet. Defund Planned Parenthood if you dare. And so the kind of the litigation power with the citizen power is critically important, and I just can't underscore that enough. Our judges who arbitrate these cases, they live in communities. They live with family members. They watch the news. And if the public sees something and is worked up and fighting it and says this is a Muslim ban that's un-American, it's more likely that the judges will also then rule from their federal benches as being un-American or unconstitutional. So the citizen engagement and the citizen pressure cannot be overstated. What we're trying to do is that we've seen a kind of a surge in our membership base since the election. It's the one good thing of the Trump administration. You have to look for always one good thing. Otherwise, we lose our optimism, and then we're really sunk. But we've seen a tripling of our membership base since the election. So we've got many more members who joined us spontaneously. They came on our website and joined the ACLU. Now we're trying to put them to work. So we organized this kind of online platform that we call peoplepower.org. People should look at it. It's a way to kind of organize kind of real people, real constituents, into a series of house parties. We launched this about 10 days ago. We had about 2,300 house parties, one in every state across the country. So people could enter in their zip code. It's built on the Bernie Sanders campaign of just empowering local leaders to take the ball and run with it. So local 2,300 hosts hosted about 210,000 people for what we call the resistance training, right, where we walk them through what are your rights in protest, what are your know your rights in the Customs Border Protection context or in a law enforcement context, what are the issues playing out with immigration or the issues playing out on reproductive rights. And then we outlined an agenda for people to begin to implement in their local cities, towns, and counties about meeting with local sheriffs to create kind of our local towns as the bulwarks that are pro-immigrant and protective of the rights of all people in those communities. And so it's critically important that we mobilize. For us, people power is a newer tool. We've always had a membership base. It's never been this big. It's never been this robust. It's never been this young. They don't want to just give you a check and say good luck to you. They want to be a part of this struggle. So now we're trying to deploy them on the advocacy on the ground. And that's where I think the assistance of people like on the Equal Voice Action Network and the work with Rami and with Stuart is going to be so critically important, because the more pressure we can muster on these issues, I think the stronger we will be at the end of these 4 years.
That's really very helpful by way of overview. And we definitely need each other. And I'm really pleased, not surprised, though, to hear you say that the litigation front obviously has to be the front edge, because obviously there's some really urgent constitutional questions being called that just we can't let pass. But thank you for acknowledging the role of community organizers and advocates and people who educate and inform our grassroots community members, because they need to understand what you all are doing in the technical and legal and professional context in order to give you the clout that you need to, and the enthusiasm and the motivation you need to see those very, very hard-fought battles through. But it's a mutual, correct. It's a mutual benefit, and we really appreciate that. Let me see if I can get Stuart and then Rami into the conversation, because you've raised some important questions, and obviously, Anthony, we invite you to stay in the discussion with us. But Stuart, how are you feeling about the general observations that Anthony has shared with us, and the particular role of litigation, which is a strong sword that you folks carry in the context of the work that you do at Asian Americans Advancing Justice. What's your sense of the issues and the role of lawyers and public interest law in helping us at least initiate a frontline effective response?
Well, thank you, Henry, and thank you, Equal Voice Action. We've really appreciated the partnership, and it's great to see Anthony and Rami, at least on the screen. I fully agree with Anthony's perspectives. We do see the legal front as a very important front of the movement. As he noted, the Congress, both the House and the Senate, are controlled mainly by conservative forces. The presidency, obviously, with President Trump. So we do see the courts as a place where people can have a fair chance at raising the important issues from our point of view. So we do think that grassroots organizations can play a very important role, not just organizing after we file cases, bringing issues to us. Mm-hmm. And we see that the grassroots organizations, for example, just last week we did a Train the Trainers with over 100 Asian American and Latino community organizations. And they came because they really wanted to not just go to court, but they really wanted to train their constituents on how to fight back. And so we've done a national webinar of our own. There were 600 groups that signed up. So we really think that the grassroots advocacy groups are key. And one other thing that we've seen as key is that in the Asian American community, oftentimes people are thinking the attacks are not on Asian Americans, but all immigrant and refugee groups are being under a siege under the Trump administration. And we started with our Asian Americans Advancing Justice Network, a standagainsthatred.org website on hate crimes. And in less than 2 months, we've gotten 110 incidents. And people may have heard about the South Asians who were killed or attacked, such as the Asian Indian man shot dead in Kansas, the Sikh immigrant shot outside of Seattle, 110 incidents. And many of the reportings came from grassroots groups and individuals. As Anthony was saying, we need to galvanize our forces. We need to unite our forces. And very importantly, an Equal Voice Action has played this very crucial role. It's not just Asian Americans who need to protest the attacks against Asian Americans. It's not just Muslim Americans who need to protest the attacks against Muslim Americans. This is our time to unite. This is our time to build a much stronger, broader movement than we've ever had before. And so the advocacy groups, the local groups are such key components of this fight back, but we can't do it in silos. We have to do it in a united way. So it's much more important for Asian Americans to go out and protest the attacks against Muslims or against African Americans or Latinos. And so this is something we really have to hold dear. And the last thing I'll just say is that we really need to hold the media accountable. There's so much misinformation in the media, and sometimes it's interesting how it comes about. There were a number of letters that were published, like in the LA Times, a paper in Montana and Washington, that basically normalized racism. And the letters were justifying the internment and the incarceration of Japanese Americans as for the protection of Japanese Americans. We need to speak out as a united movement against that kind of normalization of racism. If we don't do that together, there may be places like Montana where there aren't that many Asian Americans. And that's while we really protested the LA Times, they did make an apology for that printing of that letter, But that did not happen in Washington and Montana. So we need to be a united movement and not let racism, xenophobia, anti-immigrant, refugee sentiment become the norm. So we need each other more than ever.
Oh, those are great words of wisdom. Before I turn to Rami, I just want to ask you real quickly, Stuart, you are on the ground level there in Los Angeles where many of the initial raids took place in the last several weeks, and I'm sure you've been tracking that very carefully as we all have. What is your sense of the level of activity that you are both seeing and sensing maybe around the corner in terms of actual apprehensions in major centers like Los Angeles of not only people that may fall in the arguable, circle of eligible, if you will, individuals to be deported that the Trump administration touts, but even citizens, even people who are permanent residents getting swept up in these raids. What's your thinking about that?
There's been a very united response. ACLU and Trilla and Crescent and MALDEF and Asian Americans Advancing Justice, there's been a real united front against the raids and picking up random attacks against immigrants. The intent of this is really trying to create fear, apprehension. It is a strategy by the other side. So the question for us is not only to be united as we are now, but to be able to sustain that fight back in the longer term, because the heavier shoe has yet to drop. And so this is just the beginning. And so we have to plan for the resistance for years to come. And so I would just end by saying we really have to share our best practices in building trust. Because if we don't have that trust in the long term, the question we have to ask us ourselves is, can we sustain this fight back for the long term? And we fully anticipate things will step up. We're in the Asian American community. We don't know where the anti-China, anti-Korea sentiment will lead us. We've already seen some hate crimes because of anti-China, anti-Korea. Go back to China, and these people could have been third generation Asian Americans. So we have to stay strong and build up our infrastructure of our local groups to continue this fight back.
Thank you, Stuart, for your last thoughts. And Rami, I want to obviously bring you into this important conversation. You are, really above all, just right there on the front lines, not just in the Chicagoland area, but really nationally as a leader, really having to represent one of the most vulnerable populations on the front lines now in this new context. What are your observations? What are your responses to what you've heard so far? And how can advocates, friends, and allies of your organization and network be most helpful to you at a time like this?
Well, first, Henry, let me thank you and Equal Voice Action for facilitating this. I was delighted to hear the words of Anthony and Stuart, and also want to start by thanking both of them. And the ACLU has been doing phenomenal work, and obviously we're all indebted to the extraordinary efforts of organizations like Asian Americans Advancing Justice. I think to Stuart's larger point about connectivity, and I think that's why I so appreciate what Equal Voice Action is, I do see this moment. I think, Anthony, you were talking about, this notion that community organizers on the ground sometimes have historically been disconnected, for instance, from the policy folks on top, doing the larger 30,000-foot policy work that you have to be doing, moving at volume, moving with the type of intensity that it takes to get through these types of, extraordinary work we've seen you do, for instance, in the last couple of months. Although we should not disconnect, I think the fact that there's already a profound level of intersection, and we need to double down on that intersection. In other words, community organizing, when it's done well, is producing a base of directly affected leaders on the ground that have the most stake in the issues. And we're passing legislation in our state legislatures. Last year, Iman passed an extraordinary parole reform legislation written by one of our leaders who was on death row himself, working with a cohort of leaders in the churches and Latino organizations. Now, that has translation beyond our own state legislature in Illinois, as Anthony knows, because as you alluded to, what we're doing is building power in our state legislature so that we can then collectively on a national level begin to place a more coordinated agenda on our, you know, on our AGs and beginning our attorney generals and beginning to think about how we as local organizers can better interface, right, with our national representatives when we're doing this work. And as, you know, Iman, for instance, now doing work in Atlanta, in Chicago, we have our base there. We're thinking about that. You know, we're thinking about this framework. Over the last couple of months, for instance, to your question, Henry, immediately afterwards, I think you were at our event here in Chicago, we produced an event on MLK Day that was simultaneously going on in Chicago, in Atlanta, in Newark, in LA. The hashtag Fight Fear, Build Power was one that was trending that day on Twitter. We've had thousands of people come online, sign a pledge. And it was a profound illustration. We had churches, synagogues, LGBTQ community representation. We had organizations of all backgrounds who've been standing with us in really profound ways, understanding what I think Stuart was hitting at. Now more than ever, this connection between the way our communities historically have been criminalized needs to be fought more holistically. In other words, when we think about immigration reform, we think about criminal justice, and we think about national security, those three kind of, you know, areas, those are not the only ways in which our communities have been criminalized, but certainly those have been through the three lenses, if you will. What happens in our criminal justice system, immigration, and national security, and oftentimes those communities in organizing and in advocacy have not really talked well with one another. And have existed in silos. And so I think the promise of the moment is that it is a moment of realization, as the ACLU has seen in its membership base. And I think as any organizer in the ground, we have now a weekly session called the, you know, weekly grassroots power hour, where we're just trying to connect with ACLU and lawyers and bring legal consultation, organizing, artistic expression together as a way to sustain the energy. The one thing I would raise, and then I'll get directly to what you asked, Henry, one thing that struck me about what your analysis, Anthony, you know, thinking about your first days immediately after September 11th and the differences between now and then, I do agree that in some levels, our organizing collectively over those years have paid off in the sense that there is more holistic engagement and we're ready to respond. But I do worry about one thing, and certainly I think all of us need to be completely attuned to, is that we need to be creating the type of vision that can withstand, of course, the wear and tear of the everyday barrage, particularly on nonprofit community-based organizations across the country who are already, you know, we're here on the south side of Chicago. You know, we're in the midst of already our day-in, day-out, you know, issues. Our organizations are already running at capacity. They're already running with razor-thin kind of, you know, budgets and trying to make things work. And there are ways within which both the wear and tear, the overwhelming nature with which power can be deployed to silence, intimidate, and oftentimes distract our efforts are well tracked. These are, you know, this is the Trump administration. It'd be foolish for us to think the Trump administration is the first administration that has deployed these types of tactics. We've seen them over, there's a history of that. But I also think we have to ask the very serious question about what Anthony alluded to is, you know, and this is certainly very real for the Muslim community, is can we withstand the type of crisis that you identified in 9/11 is very different than the crisis of perhaps a shocking result of a national election. You know, I worked with the Obama administration and many people in national security, and, you know, the analysis about a domestic attack was never a question of when, it was only about if. And that was a very sober, concerning analysis. Now, we have unfortunate domestic acts of violence being perpetrated across our country every day or often by groups that have nothing to do with Muslim, Asian, or other communities that get chapped. They get filed away as an act of temporary insanity that just needs behavior health counseling, right? But we know we exist in a very different set of possibilities. Dylann Roof, there's not a white American in the United States that felt compelled to get on national television and apologize for the assault on innocent life led by Dylann Roof. We know that the unfortunate reality of persistent racism and disparities in America mean that communities of color and underrepresented communities or minority communities share the burden of having to speak on behalf of every act of lunacy by anyone who is remotely connected to our communities here or across the globe. And so certainly the Muslim community, the Muslim American community, has every very real reason to have still persistent fear and anxiety, trepidation rather, about what would happen. Can we withstand the types of things that Anthony described, right, if there were another, God forbid, attack of any sort that this administration would then capitalize upon in very horrific ways. So, you know, I'll end by saying that, you know, in addition to the Muslim ban, which of course has been an extraordinary, the resistance has been extraordinary, the larger American Muslim community has to be, you know, thoughtful about the range of other things that are also on the agenda. The Muslim registry, for instance, which is certainly a thing that has its own you know, cycle, and that's getting lost in the midst of everything else. There's also much more subtle things or insidious things that are not as well known, but could have even profoundly more crippling, criminalizing consequences. So, for instance, Ted Cruz has been for a while trying to get a piece of legislation that outlaws or that designates the Muslim Brotherhood, a international network of kind of, you know, that go back a century now across the Middle East, as a terrorist organization. Now, these are harder things to frame because most Americans don't know how to wrap their minds around, well, what consequences does that have locally and domestically? But the alt-right for years has been attempting to make, you know, shadowy fourth, fifth person connections to this larger group, to the most mainstream American Muslim organizations, like, for instance, the Council of America CARE, or the Islamic Society of North America, ISNA. You will hear them contend that these entities have some direct or indirect connection over the years to the Muslim Brotherhood across the globe. Now, however tenuous that connection may be, however spurious it may be, it's out there, and it's an attempt to create a chilling effect in the community to begin to use and marshal, you know, the powerful and very intimidating aspect of providing criminal support to terrorist entities as a way of, again, further intimidating communities. And so I think we need to be aware of that. I would end by saying that, you know, this, at least this point, if people, there are two things that I think people can do when they standing and broadly better understanding the American Muslim community. I think the first is to better understand the community. Like Stuart was mentioning, there is such, you know, little understanding of who the American Muslim community is. It gets even the most liberal and sometimes even progressive supporters find themselves susceptible to the same 30-second soundbite on who Muslims and Islam are in America. And I think it's important to acknowledge, look, the American Muslim community goes back centuries in this country. You find presence of American Muslims, the Muslims in the first, you know, part of the transatlantic slave trade. They were part of rebellions and resistance with Harriet Tubman. They're a part of slave revolts. the idea of resistance and the idea of presence in this country within the larger context of the American Muslim communities is critically important to acknowledge. This is not just a community that came here in the post-1965 immigration wave. It's a community that has been there. It is a community, more importantly, that has been an integral part of phenomenal community development and social justice work in this country for decades. In every urban center in America, it's hard not to go to communities and not find the profound influence of American Muslims on the quality of life, on negotiating gang truces, whether we're talking about South Philly, South LA, whether we're talking about Baltimore, whether we're talking about Detroit. That legacy needs to be respected and appreciated as part of the broader context of the complicated makeup of who American Muslims are. But secondly, once we acknowledge that and understand that the American Muslim community has been here and been an integral part of this work, we need to be able to find ways in which we connect dots, that the criminal justice system, national security, and immigration systems are all relying on many of the same apparatuses to carry out agendas that criminalize certain sectors of our community, and that we're all collectively affected by this. So it's not as that it's not simply standing with the Muslims, it's not standing with the Latinos. This is really standing with ourselves collectively for a better future. So I'll leave it there.
No, points well taken and really articulately presented. Thank you so much, Rami. Anthony, let me ask you, I mean, in response to what you've just heard from Rami on the level of, you know, examples of building our community, you alluded to several in terms of, you know, groups that are coming together that maybe in the past have been loosely aligned but really not tightly integrated in their efforts. So now you've got, you know, whole groups of people like Muslims, you've got Latino and Asian immigrants, you've got women, gay and lesbian people, and other communities that have probably had common cause for quite a while. But are you beginning to see more concrete signs that on the level of sustaining more tight community relations, we're moving in that direction? Or are you concerned that sustainability is also an issue once we get out 6, 12, 18 months in the battle?
No, I think it's happening. I think it's definitely coming together. And I think one thing that, Rami, I absolutely completely agree with you is that we have to build the muscle now for the longer term. And the way we're going to be able to sustain this activism for the next 4 years is to build the muscle among all of our groups to see these attacks as related to all of us, right? And it can't just be the women at the Women's March and the immigrants at the Immigrants March, or the Muslims at the Muslim March. This is really the role and the power of community organizers to see the connection between these issues and to cross-fertilize and to cross-organize and to understand, you know, that an effort to defund Planned Parenthood, to really take out one of our most storied nonprofits in America, ties back directly to Rami's point about the efforts to put the Muslim Brotherhood on a terrorist list or to ban funding from American citizens to Muslim organizations. It's an attack on our organizations of civil society. And I think Rami's exactly right that we have to build this for the longer term, because, you know, if people think that it was the women's issue, which was one flash in the pan, and then it was the immigration and detention and deportation issue, and then it's the Muslim flash in the pan, then we will have failed. And I think part of what we've got to do is we've got to have that cross-fertilizing, that willingness to get outside of our silos or our issues or our boxes and say, this affects this set of people, but it affects us all because of the way in which it's being executed. And I think it's critically important. I completely agree with Rami that the real test for us is how do we build that muscle now, so that when there is another terrorist attack, we are able to stop the Trump administration dead in its tracks from trying to implement even a more aggressive ideological agenda on national security or anti-immigrant or anti-Muslim. And I think that's part of the conversation that community organizers, people who really talk to real people, who are connected to real communities, have to prepare the American people for the inevitability of another terrorist attack. And so that we don't find ourselves in that moment, like we did in the aftermath of 9/11, where people just give the ideologue in the Oval Office the benefit of the doubt, because they're still, you know, they're still shocked by the tragedy that played out. We need to make sure that we hold people's, the government's feet to the fire in asking the tough questions. So I completely agree with Rami that that's why the work is so critical now and going forward.
Thanks, Anthony. Stuart, I want to get you in here, but I also want to urge our audience members. I'm anxious to get some questions from the audience in. We've got about 15 more minutes, so use your function on the right side of your screen on your webcam page there to ask any questions. Try and keep them brief, if you will, and direct, and we'll get to as many of those questions as we can. Stuart, anything you want to add to the course of conversation that we've just been following right now? Any words of wisdom that you would want to amplify on from Rami or Anthony on the issues?
Well, I think we're definitely on the same wavelength. We've worked together for a number of decades, so we do think alike. But I would emphasize the importance of local groups, organizing groups, advocacy groups, being the front line of defense. When you talked about some of the raids in Los Angeles, I mean, people, I don't know the number, but I could tell you millions of immigrants are scared. And so it's going to take the local organizing groups to bring information and confidence to our population that something can be done in the protection and resistance of benefit to their families. And at this very time that we're, as Rami was saying, a lot of groups are already stretched to the limit. And so in addition to sharing best practices of how to fight back, we have to do better at sharing best practices on building our resources, building our volunteer bases, building the fundraising of our local groups, because we know that we could talk to people about what to do and they get that, but when they're running and they don't see funding coming in, a few of our groups have done well in the fundraising, but not all of our groups are in that position. So I would just encourage all of us, especially we who are somewhat larger groups, need to share the best practices of how to build our capacity internally. Because otherwise, we may know what to do, but we may not have the resources to do it. And all of us are challenged. We're getting hundreds of, we already have 700 or 800 volunteers. We're getting many more volunteers, but right now we're kind of at our capacity. We're trying to figure out what to do. You know, we've had a doubling of the callers who want help with citizenship assistance in the last few months, but now we have a three-month backlog. And so now we need resources to reduce the backlog. Otherwise, we haven't even started the big push to say, if you want to become a citizen, you better start applying now. And yet, if we have a backlog, that's not going to work. So I would just encourage us to share best practices on the fight back, but also share best practices on how we could build our individual and collective resources for the long fight ahead.
Stuart.
Great points. Go ahead, Rami.
I would just also add to that both what Stuart and Anthony just said. I fully agree, and I think there's two things. Part of the local is, you know, we've been talking at EMAN and some of our organizations about kind of a three-prong response to the moment. You know, deepening offensive defense, if you will. The deepening is we need to recognize that institutions at this moment, we need to find ways to creatively galvanize resources to institutionalize the nonprofit sector that are leading this front all across the country. And that means finding creative ways of shaking loose more dollars. And, you know, our advocates in philanthropy, our advocates in the private sector, our advocates have means and resources need to say now more than ever, we can't have these organizations, as you know, Stuart, most of us. I mean, I know in the American Muslim community, for instance, the nonprofit sector is still relatively new. You take an organization like ours, we've been around 20 years, that's considered a little more seasoned. Although we have decades of organizing and activism, but building up institutional capacity is still very anemic. Most of our institutions are if they're lucky, 5-7 months out within their operating budgets. Many are going month by month, many week by week, and some day by day. And so we need to take that into consideration. Having a strong offense is doing all the collective work that we're doing right now and being prepared for another tactic, which is the divide and conquer, which we already see, for instance, in Chicago. We're going, we already see propositions of hundreds of millions of dollars in jobs, right, being pitted against the sanctuary city status of the city. And that is going to be squarely pointed at the quote-unquote black-brown divides, right? Latinos and African Americans and others saying, you know, you're in these low-income African American communities on the south and west side with 40-45% unemployment. We have a $1 trillion job offer that's going to cycle some jobs into your city if you can put pressure on your mayor or on your council to let up off this sanctuary city nonsense. And you're going to start seeing this. You've already seen the cracks in certain cities. You're going to see that. So they're going to play. We have to be prepared for that type of strategy playing itself out across the country. And going back to what you said, Stuart, I think that happens in the trenches when organizations, when leaders understand each other's histories, genuinely see the connectivity between deporting and detaining Latino families and the stability of quality of life for Black, Latino, Arab families, and understand that as one singular effort. And so I just echo that kind of sentiment that we do need to double down and we need our defenses, and that for our last strategy about really having the legal support, I think, Anthony, your ability to make sure that ACLU and that we're better connecting to the ACLU on these local crowds, that we have all the legal muscle necessary to sustain the type of stuff that we're dealing with on an everyday basis on the ground. And we're not just talking about the big executive orders. I'm talking about also formerly incarcerated individuals or the returning citizens that have to deal with now another era of getting tough on crime, a hyper, you know, further privatization of our criminal justice system that is further eroding the rights of 20,000 people coming back every year in the state of Illinois. All of this is directly connected, and I think that's part of that work on the ground as well.
Mm. Yeah, so what's striking to me at this point of the conversation is that while it's clear and obvious that we have a lot of work to do in relationship to the problem, namely the external problem posed by the Trump administration, the Congress, and those that think like them, there's a lot of work to do within our own ranks. There's a lot of integration, alignment of efforts, there's a lot of trust building and relationship building and sustainability work that we have to put in place. So I'm really pleased that those points have come out, because that's where an organization and network like Equal Voice Action, I think, can contribute to the equation in terms of Stuart's points, lifting up models, examples, winning strategies, bringing together leaders for conversations like this, trying to connect dots that maybe other groups situated more locally or regionally are not going to connect because they're too isolated in those locations. Those are places and spaces where organizations like ours can and must be helpful. So I appreciate that coming up. On the matter of resourcing, I've got an important question from the audience that I want to pose to you folks, which is the following. Can you describe specific ways in which grant makers and funders can assist in building larger configurations of power sharing along the lines of building the community that we've just been talking about? Anthony, you're a former grant maker. We have some history in that space. You want to start that part of the conversation, a real quick answer, and then I'll see if Rami or Stuart want to add to that?
I'm sure Rami and Stuart have much more to add, but I would say that for the donors on the call and people who are connected to grant makers, they need to look at the full ecosystem. And one of the things that I find a little bit frustrating is that the donors sometimes are kind of chasing the most recent fad or whim, right? And, you know, clearly litigation is going to be important. And there's a lot of discussion about how we can build up the litigation muscle of different groups. Yeah, there's a number of efforts about talking about creating new legal institutions. I don't really know if that's what we need, frankly. You know, I think there's a lot of donors and some other folks who are trying to say we need to build a new type of legal organization. I think we have a very robust legal community. The Stewards Group is amazing in LA, and MALDEF and the ACLU and the Legal Defense Fund. You know, I'd be looking more at the ecosystem. And I think it's critically important that people don't think that any one organization can do this and that we've got it covered. We certainly do not have it covered at the ACLU. This is too big, right? We have 300 plus lawyers who are litigators across the country. Jeff Sessions has 11,291 litigators working for him. There are 19,000 lawyers who work for the U.S. Justice Department, Department of Homeland Security, Department of Health and Human Services. So, you know, we need to look at the whole ecosystem and be really smart about how we deploy those resources. And I think that the only way legal groups that have a track record and a history can be kind of be robust in this time is if there's a direct connection to the grassroots and to the broader ecosystem. And as part of what we're trying to do at the ACLU is to do exactly what Rami suggested, is how do we take some of our resources and make them available and useful for other people? So we have a whole bunch of Know Your Rights brochures, right, in every different language. What do you do when you're stopped by a cop? What do you do when you're visited by a Customs Border Protection person? What do you do when law enforcement comes into your community? And there are all these different languages. People should feel totally, my general counsel will probably kind of want to shoot me for this, people should feel free to take that content, take off our letterhead and logo, and put their own letterhead and logo on it and just disseminate it, right? The whole point of this is to have it out there for people, right? You don't have to distribute an ACLU brochure if you're running the La Raza Centro Legal. So put your own name on it. Steal it. You know, take the content, steal it, but take the content, right? It's there for a reason. And I think that we need to put demands upon organizations like ours who can produce these things. We've done it in videos, in Know Your Rights brochures. There's this mobile justice app which we've helped develop, and Rami's been a part of it in Chicago and LA and elsewhere, but people can download what are their Know Your Rights information when they're in a police encounter. And I think we need to find a way of spreading these resources more broadly. And I think for the donors in the room, they've got to build up the organizational capacity, especially of the smaller tier and middle tier organizations, because they're the ones with the staying power. They're the ones who connect the people to the issues. And I think if anyone thinks, oh, okay, the civil liberties crisis is kind of, you know, handled because we got Stewart and Anthony who are running good organizations with resources, they're missing the big part of the piece. And I think that the organizing piece has got to be an essential priority for donors and to get the information in front of communities. I think donors need to give general support. They need to give the smaller groups multi-year grants with no strings. Let them run. When you have a leader like Rami, you don't want to kind of tie his hands up into benchmarks and little boxes and six-month reports and maybe we'll renew after the 6 months. You believe in somebody and you believe in this leader and you believe in this organization, give them a long-term check and let them run for it. And I think part of that conversation is not to say, the donors I'm talking to for the ACLU, I'm not asking them for a year. I'm asking them for a four-year commitment. So this president is going to be in the office unless he gets impeached, and then we've got Michael Pence. But somebody we don't like is going to be in that office for 4 years. So don't give me 6 months or one-year commitment. If you want us to do this work, make a longer-term commitment to building this capacity. And that's especially true for the smaller groups who don't have the resources that some of us who are longer term and been around this block a little bit longer have been fortunate to muster. But I think it's critically important right now.
I'm running up against our time constraints, but I wanted to thank Anthony for that thought. Anthony, just a real quick question, very quick. On sanctuary cities, do you have any current listing at ACLU on the cities that are advancing formal policies in that space?
Yeah. And I guess the best place for people to find out more about it is to email me at aromero@aclu.org or Omar Jadwat, who's the head of our Immigrants' Rights Project, Jadwat, J-A-D-W-A-T, at aclu.org. I mean, there's been a number, There's litigation already out of Santa Clara, out of California, about trying to preemptively strike down the kind of the executive order that was going to try to penalize sanctuary cities. I think we got to be really smart about this. I think the question that Rami raised is exactly right. They're going to try to kind of divide and conquer. And I think that there's got to be both the litigation against some of these actions, and I think there's the kind of the organizing and the political pressure on elected officials. And the thing I'll just say is I think the political process is working, right? Mm-hmm. People are turning out at these town halls. They're holding their elected officials' feet to the fire. Folks in Washington are scared, right? Look at these Republicans. They're running on the whole question about whether this repeal and replace of Obamacare is going to work in their home state. And I think that's a sign that the constituent pressure, the people pressure, is a way to it is working. And if we can keep the pressure on, then I think all to the good, and especially on sanctuary.
Rami, yeah, Stuart, I'm going to give you and Rami about 30 seconds each for a final word, and then I'm going to have to wrap. So let me get you guys in here.
Well, I definitely think. I want to thank you again, Henry, and Equal Voice Action. I really want to start a process or strengthen a process with Eva where there is that sharing. I would say for those of us who are heads of large organizations, we need to advocate when foundations want to fund us that we want to have partnerships. The power sharing really starts with all of us, and so we need to advocate for power sharing. I'm proud to say our last three grants we advocated, and so we will be re-granting to a number of partners in areas geographically, ethnically, religiously that don't always get the grants. So we need to play a leadership role to make sure that our partners who are at the front line have the resources for this huge fight back to come.
Thank you, Stuart. Rami, I'm going to give you the last word on that.
No, I concur with everything I've said, and thank you, Anthony and Stuart. It's an honor being on the panel with you. I do want to say to Henry and to Equal Voice Action, I do think we need to, part of the larger conversations, particularly to the foundations and funders, whether they're in philanthropy or private funders, to lift up best practices. We wouldn't have Equal Voice, and quite frankly, we wouldn't have a cohort of many nonprofit grassroots organizations in Chicago, for instance, that have been doing the work for the last 15 years if it wasn't for visionaries like Luz Vega Marquez and Marguerite Casey, who quite frankly fought for a vision of multi-year general support, multi-alliance building, when that wasn't very popular to do in philanthropy.
So true.
And we're seeing that now. Kellogg and I think our partners at Ford are beginning to be more receptive towards that, but we need to push the envelope and double down on that so that, Stuart, we can do more of that. We can strengthen our own institutions, move forward collectively towards a common vision that can be sustainable throughout not just the 4 years, but well beyond that.
Points well taken, and a wonderful exchange. Thank you so much to all of our great presenters and friends. That wraps up our time today. Thank you so much for all of you joining us. If you missed any parts of today's conversation or want to share it with colleagues, which we encourage, we'll be releasing it soon through Equal Voice Action's website and our iTunes podcast. Be sure also to check out the ample resources and opportunities provided by our stellar partner organizations on today's call, ACLU.org, AdvancingJustice-LA.org, and Iman, I-M-A-N, Central.org, all have a host of useful tools and opportunities for defending and advancing equal rights and allied causes, and we urge you to check out and stay abreast of these resources. And of course, if you enjoyed today's virtual discussion and haven't joined already, please consider, we urge you to consider becoming a member of Equal Voice Action. Our voices are strongest together. Visit EqualVoiceAction.com and use our code EVAFREE, EVAFREE, for a complimentary year of membership. Please be sure also to stay tuned for more learning opportunities as we come together to amplify the voices and power of working and striving families across our nation and fight for the issues that we believe in. Thanks again for joining us today and for all the important work that you all do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.